Here we go. Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for your patience. This is Lynn Johnson and Bruce Rawls today with the Journey Home by Dr. Ken Wapnick, and I just had to reboot my computer. Rebooted at first, it said reboot and do the updates, which I did, and then it wouldn't do anything. So I had to push the button and actually shut it down because nothing was working. And when I turned it back on, it says, "Do you want to do the updates?" And I said, "Oh, I thought I just did." But I didn't, obviously. So it did the updates, and I just came back on right before you called. So meantime, drinking coffee and coughing and through trying to inhale coffee through my lungs. It's a new way to get the caffeine real quick. but anyway, no, that's my morning so far. Actually, just the past 10 minutes. everything was, well, not everything was working fine. But I couldn't open Skype. I couldn't do anything. So maybe Mercury's in retrograde? I don't know. Got to blame something. Anyway, how are you doing today, Bruce?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm just getting our book open.
Okay.
And I got new glasses this week, and I'm seeing much, much better. You know, I could have had a real grievance. I decided against it because, you know, heaven is a decision that I must make. But you know, I've been having, over the past, you know, year, a couple, since I had that last surgery, eye surgery, and, you know, my vision has just been worse and worse and worse to where now I thought I would never really be able to see a lot of stuff, you know. So I decided I wanted to get new glasses before I went to the conference. Because at least, you know, maybe they could give me something to help out a little bit. And I went to a different doctor. And this doctor said, you know, checked out my vision and said, you know, how have you been, you know, how's this been working for you? And I said, oh, it's just terrible. You know, I'm having a lot of times I can't even read words because they are skewed or blurry or whatever. And it's because the last time they gave me a prescription with really high astigmatism correction. And I have a little bit of astigmatism, but not nearly that much. And so for the past year and a half, or almost 2 years since I've had those glasses, I have not been seeing correctly. Everything has been askew, right? Everything has been like off kilter, and so I got new glasses, and all of a sudden I can read and I can see the stars. And I was in my bathroom, and I looked at this shelf, and I could read the labels of the things that were on my shelves. And so I opened the window and looked outside, and I could see the stars. And I actually cried. I mean, I was like, you know, I was just very emotional about, you know, wow, I can see these things that I couldn't see before. And so
sounds kind of symbolic here.
Yeah. Really, yeah, very, very symbolic. And I don't know what to say other than, you know, I got new glasses and now I can see. So
great. That's really cool.
Yeah. So, but, you know, at the time I was like, well, the reason I didn't go before, I didn't think I could afford it. And I didn't think I could afford it now either because I'm going to that conference. But I said, you know, I got to do it anyway because, you know, even if I'm traveling alone, I need as much of an advantage as I can because I really do only have one eye. So that, you know, kind of, it, you know, kind of makes it difficult anyway. But, You know, it's
cool. I can relate to that. I have an nine. It's pretty blurry. And it's also another good symbolic reminder, you know, let your eye be single.
That's right. That's
if
right.
If we want to get a little biblical here. Right?
You know, I thought
that's meant to be taken on a biological level, but certainly in a metaphoric one, works pretty good. You know, it's having a decision I must make, and if we choose just one teacher, and that's the teacher of kindness, then the other stuff will eventually drop away, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, I guess for me, I always thought that I'm pretty hard-headed. I'm really good at, you know, catching on and believing. Like, as soon as I knew about A Course in Miracles, I knew it was true. You know, I'm really good about that. But then when it comes then to doing what they're telling you to do, you know, somehow I think I know better. And so, you know, I'm really the kind of person that has to be hit with a completely lose your right eye. In order to say, oh, okay, yeah, you know, I do need to have my eye be single. I mean, really, you know, I guess I'm just really obtuse, maybe, if that's a word. I'm sure obstructionist. And that's, you know, the lesson today is talking about all the obstructions that we put in front of us that keep us
from... Are you obstructing the justice of God?
Obstructing, yeah. And God, guess what? Everywhere I look, all I see is obstruction. You know, it's like... It's the world news now. It's like obstruction, and you know, what is that telling me? If it's here, if it's only here for me, then what's it saying about my mind? Okay.
Well, I use the obstruction of justice phrase not only to tie it to current events, but also politically, but also as kind of a segue for something I'd like to share just for a moment or two, and that is for the first time ever I actually was on a jury, and it was kind of an interesting experience because I got to think about both in a literal and figurative sense, you know, how our you know, not only our, in this country, our judicial system is geared toward an adversarial orientation to everything, and certainly duality and polarity are key essential ingredients in our judicial system and every other aspect of our culture for that matter. But it was interesting to just kind of watch the two thought systems at work in every person in the courtroom, myself and the other five jurors and the defense attorney and the prosecuting attorney and the judge and all the other, you know, officials and witnesses, and it's just kind of interesting to just kind of notice how you know, we all vacillate between the two thought systems, and yet the way out of it is to recognize that in truth nothing happened, and in truth no one is guilty, even though in this particular case I was involved in, there was a you know, a verdict that we reached as jurors that four of the five counts that he was charged with, this person was we found, and based on factual evidence, you know, again, kind of tying into the level of confusion idea.
Yes.
That A Course in Miracles asked us to keep in mind all the time, you know, on a the basis of the data that was presented, four of those things were, you know, kind of cut and dry, and basically, you know, this was what happened, and this was the law, and according to that, you know, that was the reason for the quote-unquote guilty verdict, but the more important, to me, you know, take-home lesson was, I didn't have to make this person guilty in my mind as a person, and that's why in the jurors' room, when we were deliberating the merits of each of these counts that were presented against him, we all unanimously realized that the harassment charge had to do with intent that we had no idea what was going on in his mind, and there was not conclusive evidence, and so we made a point to, when the judge came into the chamber, we said we want to make sure that the sentencing. And, you know, our recommendation is the sentencing include something that addresses the mental health issues that were brought up. And I was thinking, wow, isn't that true for all of us? We're all paranoid schizophrenic. we're not all pathologically insane or anything like that, but we're all pathological liars in the sense that we all continue to maintain that we're separate from each other, we're separate from perfect oneness, we're separate from all that is, and our whole, our lives are just so steeped in that, we don't even, it's like, asking a fish about water, it's like, what's that, it's just, that's what we live in and move and have our being, so to speak. And anyway, it's just kind of an interesting experience for me, so I just thought I'd share some of the metaphysical, take-home lessons that occurred to me from this experience, including I was there 2 days. The first case I was dismissed from, as I shared some things in my personal history that I thought might be, just this full disclosure might bias me to, even though I could be impartial, and I just thought, well, it's they selected other particular trial. I came back the next day, and then I was selected for the one that I did participate in. And it was interesting because the first day I was kind of in a dark space in my mind, and I realized that I was, with that thought system, everything seemed to be a no-win scenario, not only for the people in the cases that were being tried, but the jurors and myself. And it was kind of like I was in a dark space, and I just kind of watched that. And then the next day, I was like, wait a minute, I could see some of this. And it had nothing to do with the particulars of the circumstance. I mean, it could have been, me out gardening or doing some web work or on a trip somewhere else in the country or it doesn't matter. It was just kind of interesting to notice that here I was in the identical physical situation in terms of the location and, most of the people that I was surrounded with and the intent of the procedure and so forth, the judicial process. But I had a completely different experience the second day because I had chosen a different teacher for the most part, and it was really inspiring that unanimously all five of the other jurors and myself realized that we wanted to, our vote was for compassion regardless of what the quote unquote law was. So anyway, that was that was very helpful for me, and it was basically an acknowledgement of that everyone is fighting a hard battle, and I think at some level we all recognize that and want peace for everyone from the sane part of our mind. So anyway.
Exactly, absolutely. And that's kind of what has come to me. You do, like, the first time, you kind of forget, what your purpose is. And at the beginning of a situation, or sometimes during the situation, you may go into a situation like that and be clear and focused on, here's my purpose here. A lot of people won't even go on a jury. A lot of people from A Course in Miracles say, well, I can't judge. I don't believe in guilt. Bullshit. Excuse my language. But that's not true. And you are judging, constantly, all the time, about everything. Mm-hmm. So, this is a way to look at your judgments in a, in a, real and metaphoric way as well.
Yeah.
And also, I know I'd be real interested, although I don't want to go into it now, but, your experiences of, the other jurors, what they, what their perception was. I was on a jury trial once where two of the jurors were deaf. I mean, not deaf, like, they were elderly and hard of hearing. So they didn't really understand what was going on. And so they, both of them, thought that the plaintiff was the defendant. And that the defendant was the plaintiff. They thought
Then, as you're saying that, I was thinking, the curriculum that we're sharing on a weekly basis here is that there's no difference in truth between victim and victimizer, because that basically is basically an affirmation of duality and separation. If we think there's a difference between victim and victimizer, then we're basically saying duality happened, and it's I'm making it real, and so therefore by that sentence and that jurisdiction, I hereby proclaim myself and anyone that my mind touches condemned. You know, end of sentence.
yeah. There you go. Yeah. Exactly. So wow, yeah, it is quite a way to for Jesus to remind us.
It is. And so as a result, I had two conversations that are typically monthly with both C.A. Brooks and Susan Dugan, and two recordings, and I shared similar accounts with them, and we also talked about, you know, the relinquishment of judgment and how it's impossible to judge in truth, and those kind of things, and the difference between sin and error. I brought that into the conversation with Susan yesterday afternoon, because that to me was one of those pivotal ideas that when I first started actually reading the Course, I knew about for several years, but when I actually cracked the books and I remember backpacking in High Sierra with the text, and I was going through it and for the first time, and it's like, oh my gosh, sin versus error. Those are two completely different ideas and with completely different outcomes for peace of mind. Sin being the condemnation that is unresolvable and irreconcilable, and error is just like, oh, I've taken a wrong turn into a cul-de-sac. I just need to turn this thing around and get back in the thoroughfare. it's a very different feeling when, and just like those, the 2 days that where I was in a dark place the first day and for the most part, and then again, largely even the second day, I was like, oh, I am choosing to see peace instead of this. And it was a very different experience, even though the circumstances were nearly identical in many respects. So, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So let us see what Dr. Ken has to say.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
yeah.
there's probably something right now about this, because that's the way it works somehow with this teaching. So I'm going to let you start. I think I'm on location 736. So.
Oh, okay. Whatever that is.
Whatever that is.
This is actually an interesting aside. At some point, there may be a need for a global annotation system like A Course in Miracles now has, that's on both the ACIM.org and FACIM.org websites. There's reference on how to use the annotation, which basically gives you a chapter, section, paragraph, and sentence notation. So no matter what version you're reading, whether it's in print form, Treeware, or online in various formats, you can quickly all be on the same page, literally and figuratively. And in the case of what you and I have been doing, I'm reading a Treeware version and you're reading a digital version. And then the added advantage, too, that multiplies it manyfold is whenever you have translated versions, and since A Course in Miracles has been translated by the Foundation for Inner Peace into 27 languages and counting, literally it transcends the language barrier as well, because you can refer to the same quotation in all those different languages by knowing the annotation. So anyway, be that as may.
That is very cool. I didn't realize that, it does make sense. Yeah, but yeah.
So I encourage people to use the annotations that are on both the FIP site now and the FACIM site. You can just click, look on under annotations, under resources, and find it on both places. So anyway, I have us on the page 58, and what's being quoted here now, presumably from chapter 19, since almost the whole book is about it, is as you look upon the world, this little wish, and then in brackets Ken has, to keep out the Holy Spirit in his peace, and end of bracket, uprooted and floating aimlessly, can land and settle briefly upon anything, for it has no purpose now. And so the wish really is the ego's wish to make differences real, to make a big deal out of grievances and victimhood and projection and take the idea that we're able to shatter perfect oneness, but it's not my fault, and so therefore it's everyone else in this outer shield of oblivion, but that's not what we. Now, that's not how we usually look at it, but that's the mechanism by which we project out our unconscious guilt and then assign it to everyone else but ourselves, typically. And that's the uprooted, aimlessly floating wish that lands and settles briefly upon anything. And the no purpose really is recognizing that in truth there is no purpose for the ego. But because we've given it a purpose, it seems real for us. So anyway, here's Ken's commentary. So what has happened now is that we have dislodged this guilt sufficiently, and it no longer has the power over us it once had. So now he's talking about when we look at it and recognize that it's ineffective. It is just floating around and can land on almost anything. This is when we will experience the most trivial things in the world as upsetting. If somebody does not look at us quite right, or our buttons get pushed when we hear about a particular situation. In other words, we wish to preserve our individuality by keeping the Holy Spirit out of our minds. Ends up being projected out by our blaming others for doing to us what we secretly believe we did to God and Jesus. That underlying, because it seems like that's at the crux of the metaphysics of the Course, isn't it? And since the original thought is nothing, the projections of it must be nothing too. It is the purpose of A Course in Miracles, therefore, to teach us that the power of the world, our projections, has no power when we uncover its source, the belief in the reality of the separation buried in our minds. This is nicely described in the following passage, which follows the discussion of our substitutions of fear for the reality of God's love. And this is from chapter 18, section 1, paragraph 7. And it says, your little senseless substitutions, touched with insanity and swirling lightly off on a mad course like feathers dancing insanely in the wind, have no substance. They fuse and merge and separate in shifting and totally meaningless patterns that need not be judged at all. Courtroom or no.
That's it.
To judge them individually is pointless. Their tiny differences in form are no real differences at all. None of them matters. That they have in common and nothing else. Yet what else is necessary to make them all the same? Let them all go dancing in the wind, dipping and turning till they disappear from sight far, far outside of you, and turn you to the stately calm within, wherein holy stillness dwells the living God you never left and who never left you.
Wow. Oh, my God. I know I've read this before. This is incredible. That is so beautiful. I mean, it's so poetic, but it's exactly the same thing as today's lesson.
Yeah.
Do you notice that?
Sure, sure.
You're listening. Well,
there's a certain consistency and commonality to all the lessons and all the writing of the courses.
But yeah, but today's lesson is basically talking about, it's basically saying, look at all your crazy beliefs, all these thoughts that you have. Look at all the things that you think are, you know, real and can impact you and change you and make you think this and make you feel that. And, you know, look at all of them and, you know, just recognize they're just nothing. It's just, these are just mad beliefs. And, and you know, I love how he just, it's like they're dancing in the wind and they're, they're swirling just around you and, so cool.
Little clouds of dust and feathers and you know, substanceless stuff, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And trees. Yeah.
Yeah. My little grandson was here this weekend or yesterday and day before, and we were talking about the wind and how you know, Grandma, what is the wind? You know, why? You know, how can it? What is happening here? And he's 5, and you know, I said, well, that's just air. That's all air. You know, air that you are walking through, air that you're breathing in and everything. You know, it's air and it's moving really fast. And when it's moving really fast, or you know, I tried to explain it to him, but all it is just air that's under pressure or less pressure, and moving, fast. And, you know, it can pick up your house. And last night, yesterday, my sister's house got hit by a tornado. I said it can do all that, knock everything over, but it's just air. It's the same thing you're breathing right now.
And, did she see a woman in dark on a bicycle? Or
she was on her way to Branson, Missouri. They were 300 miles away. They had they were taking a trip for my brother-in-law's birthday, and they got a call from the family that their house had got hit. So she was calling me from a hotel room because they had to stop and take a rest. They're in their 70s. She's just turned 75 this year, and he's probably 3 or 4 years older than her. So they're they need to take a little bit of a rest before they drove 300 miles back home. But anyway, the story is, it's just air, and yet it seems so impactful and horrible and can do so much damage. Mm-hmm. It's nothing. And that's what Jesus is talking to us about here. You know, these ideas that we have and all these things that upset us. And there was something I wanted to say. Let me go back a page and look. The projection thing that he's talking about. Isn't it interesting that when, like, if you look at the news and you watch, like, Donald Trump, and I'm not trying to bring up politics, this is just interesting to me. He is accusing the Democrats of conspiracy and treason. When it appears the evidence is just the opposite is true. That's how it appears to me, because that's how I want to see it. To, some portion of the people in this country, in this world, they see it that way. And yet it's the same thing. It's the elephant. I've got the ear and he's got the tail. I mean, but we're projecting on each other our own guilt.
Exactly. No matter how many blind men you have, addressing that elephant, you're not going to get the full story, and it's going to be distorted. And I think that's such a great analogy. Whether it's three or six or an infinite number of blind men addressing that elephant, there's the elephant in the room is really the unconscious guilt, unless we look at it with the Holy Spirit, we're not going to get an adequate understanding. And we're going to misunderstand because we're going to think that it's about the form or that it's about specifics. And it's really always about looking at the cause of the projection, the motivation and the why, the purposiveness of making up a world of elephants and wind and courtrooms everything, tornadoes, the whole gamut of stuff is really purposive to the ego's way of thinking, in that it's basically designed to keep a separate self intact, thinking that we're getting some kind of mileage out of it that's working for us, but when we actually stop and look and see realistically, honestly, and dispassionately, what the ego has ever done for us, unlike John Cleese listing the things that the Romans did do for them, love of Christ, we will actually have to admit, in all honesty, that the ego has really done nothing beneficial for us, and all of the many years we've paid homage to it.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and that's hilarious.
It is. I mean, it's just a silly, silly joke that we've made into such a big deal. Yeah, I was thinking, this might even be a good title for a book or something. I'm claiming the virtual copyright here at the moment is I think we're sort of all on a Giltigan's Island tour. We thought it was going to be 3 hours, but keep bringing the guilt back again to this island in our mind of separation, and it's just a comedy. It's just a complete year after year, just a silly sitcom in our mind that we've taken seriously and made such a big deal out of it. But it was, you know, it wasn't even a 3-hour tour. It was a 3-nanosecond tour that we made into a whole cosmos, you know.
We are so creative, the guilt of
innocence. Aren't we, though?
And by the way, I don't think you can copyright a title.
I'll just use this recording as the initial claim for the pun. How's
okay, I agree. All right. Should I read on?
Please do. Sure.
Okay. Let's see. Let me see.
It's at the top of page 59 for anybody who's reading the text.
Okay, what the hell did I
do? It's right after the quote from chapter 18, the 2-paragraph quote.
I know. How did I? Oh, I see what happened. I changed the page size, and it changes where it's located. Okay, therefore, so he's been talking about how all these things are just seem to be happening, and they just are, you know, swirling it around in our consciousness, and as we begin to let go of our attachment to them, or let go of our decision to believe in them, as we let go of all of those things, then they do begin to still in your mind and calm down. And that was the quote from chapter 18 that you read, which was just blew me away when I heard it. So poetic and beautiful. So therefore, whenever something in the world upsets us, major or minor, we should think of this purpose and realize that the object of our distress is but a fragmentary shadow of the original thought of separation, which we were trying to reinforce so that our individual existence would be even more securely protected against the threat of our remembering to choose God's love instead of the special love of the ego. Which, that's really a very succinct way of describing what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, we are really trying to protect our individual, our individual freedom, our individual rights, my individual personality. You don't know how many Course in Miracles students, and maybe I have no idea, will say, yeah, but we have individual souls because, you know, Jesus talks about sons of God. And so we are, you know, we still are going to have a personality when we exit this illusion. And I'm like, and we're going to know our loved ones. And I'm like, what course are you reading?
I think we're given a graceful, gentle curriculum, though. And I love what Tim Wise and Lynn Corona in their classes, in recalling one of Ken's phrases, who have been bringing up frequently lately, and that is, you know, when we get to the point where we have really understood and mastered and truly applied A Course in Miracles, there'll be typically a long period of time where we go peace long before we go poof. Before that individuality is gone altogether, before we, you know, yes, master the fifth stage in the development of trust and let go altogether of the idea there's a separate self that is doing the course kind of thing and all that stuff. So you know, we don't have to worry about that. I think we can kind of notice it and smile gently when we recognize, oh, I'm still making it about the Bruce character who's quote unquote doing the course. You know, when the course is done, there won't be a Bruce, but there will be a shared identity that I will have fully re-embraced, I'm the only one playing hooky, and in truth, everyone's already home, and I'm the only one dreaming of exile. So
exactly.
I just need to keep remembering that, and then I'll stay on course.
Yeah, I'm the only one I need to even think about or worry about, because I'm the only one that I have any. I'm the only one, actually.
Exactly.
And all you
are, I'm the only straggler. Yeah.
What appears to be you is a projection of my thinking that I'm in a world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a little bit unbelievable. if you think, well, then that means that I don't exist either, which is true. So the I
as
saying
a,
that
as a separate self, and yeah. I think that's important.
Yeah.
To
the I that's saying that though is doesn't. I mean, really, the I that thinks it's Lynn doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's a you know, something people do not want to hear.
Yeah, a little, you know, of course, yeah. That's what it is, enormous resistance to looking at the Course. And Ken talks about this, Ken Wapnick, in his lectures. He's, you know, and he's on many of the recordings I've listened to, he says, you know, addressing typically the folks in Temecula at the time, how, you know, you leave the room and, you know, pointing to the door on the, what was it, north side of the building there, I guess it was, and how, you know, once you go out that door, it's almost like there's an invisible vacuum cleaner that's taking everything you heard and sucking it out of your mind, and you know, but that's, we do that when we lift our eyes from the page as we're reading, we you know,
exactly.
Or even while we're reading, you know, yes. if you read something, you say, wow, did I read that 2 minutes ago?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, I don't even recall reading that, you know, and it's like how the book seems fresh and anew each time. Well, I think a big part of that is due to the fact that we have tremendous resistance to this because we're so invested in this idea of a personal individual self. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just ineffective. And I think that's what the Course comes at from so many different angles. And it's a gradual, gentle curriculum of letting go of all of our, you know, totally dysfunctional behavior until we look at the root of the whole problem, which is the idea that we're a separate self altogether. And that's the little SSSS, my favorite late, recent acronym of silly, seemingly separate self. And, if I can just look at that with a little grin and inner grin and say, oh, there it is. I'm wanting to make that the big deal again, and just, you know, learn to let go of that. Only because what the real self that's, you know, the answer to the revelation really of what's always been there, that I, as an ego, made up as a substitution for that all-encompassing peace, that real shared identity is so profoundly wonderful that ego is terrified to even admit that there's a possibility that that real identity exists, in fact, is the only thing that exists, and in fact, transcends and makes the ego virtual reality game of thrones and terror and destruction and dragons raising cities and you know, guilty verdicts in courtrooms and we watched another episode of Oliver Stone and you know, world wars and megalomaniac dictators and you know, the whole gamut of stuff. All that stuff is just stuff in our minds we made up to keep us in a state of fear and guilt and sin and to avoid the peace of God, which is totally nuts when we think about it sanely, right?
It absolutely, totally nuts. And yet, it's been my experience. I mean, that's, you know, my experience and how I, you know, began. I was thinking, I read Chapter 5. I used to have to ride the bus from Denver or from Aurora, or not Aurora, Inglewood, to Colorado Springs every day, both ways, because I worked up in Denver. I would read the Course and Chapter 5. I would read Chapter 5 one day, and I'd be like, oh, my God, this is so amazing. And the next day, I would get on the bus, and I would start, and I would look back at, you know, Chapter 5, and it was like, what is this? And I would read it again and be like, oh, my God, that's
so
amazing.
When did they have that?
And then the next, and I did that every day for, like, it seemed like a couple of weeks. But I just kept going back and going, this, and finally I just said, you know, this is nuts. You know, I got to move on. But, but none of the other, you know, the other chapters I was, 1, 2, 3, 4, I was fine with. You know, I got to Chapter 5. This is when I first started studying the Course. It was just like, you know, I couldn't put it down. And now, you know, I look at Chapter 5, and again, you know, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I can't believe how profound the things are in there. It just happened to jive with me. But, you know, it's it happens every day. I looked at today's lesson. I'm like, have I read this lesson before? This thing we just read from chapter 18, have I seen this before? You know, you'd think I would remember that. You know, that's just so amazing. And yet, yeah, it's that oblivion.
Yeah, we double shield of oblivion.
Yep.
Make up a world to hide from the unconscious, unbounded guilt in the mind, and maintain those facades at all costs. That's the ego's unspoken mantra, isn't it?
Yep, trying to keep God out. Really, just don't hide from God. Don't let Him find us. Don't let Him see us. And then every time we read something that says, hey, I know where you are, I'll come get you when you're ready. You know, it's like, hey.
Exactly. It's that gentle inner Maytag repairman that's just waiting for our call.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. Okay. So the decision to be angry and to attack people was really a decision to make sin real because it keeps us separate. Thus, the mighty purpose of our wish to be separate was to keep our individuality safe and secure.
This before you go, did we read the paragraph before that?
No. You know what? I didn't.
I think we did.
I moved you over on top of it, so I thought I had done it. Okay.
I thought there was word merit in that paragraph.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. Before the Holy Spirit entered to abide with you, it seemed to have a mighty purpose in brackets. For example, that insane wish to keep that barrier between ourselves and peace. End of brackets. The insane wish to keep the barrier between ourselves and peace. The fixed and unchangeable dedication to sin and its results. Now it is aimless, wandering pointlessly, causing no more than tiny interruptions. In love's appeal. Ooh, that is cool. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that fits in exactly with what we're saying, is that, you know, that in truth, all those little perturbations between perfect peace that flit across our mind as in the previous, you know, like little dancing feathers in the wind kind of thing, little dust motes, you know, it's just like, it's just really nothing. And that it takes a while before we recognize it, because they seem like, you know, massive, you know, 5 foot thick steel doors that are, you know, bolted and welded shut, you know, against any kind of light entering in our mind. But we have to gradually, you know, laser through using Holy Spirit's understanding through the illusion of those obstacles until we realize that they're just nothing. And so this is actually sort of an optimistic account of where we will be at the point at which, you know, our day, you know, sort of statistically is devoted more and more toward peace, and then it's just a moment on the radar when we think, well, gosh, you know, should I go back to that insane ego? And then, you know, we quickly dismiss it. That didn't work so well. I think I'll skip that again.
Yeah, yeah, so. And it does get quicker and quicker every time.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we need to be patient with ourselves. So you know that day will arrive more quickly, where it's automatic rather than automatic choosing the Holy Spirit rather than automatically reverting to the ego's threatened defenses.
Yeah. And you know what? For me, it's gotten to be that way much. I mean, seriously, my first default is, you know, oh, let's look at this a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, after the first initial spike of panic, then it's the, oh, let's look at this a different way. So, you know, eventually it comes to where there's no spike of panic. And I've seen that also. I've seen that in a lot of things that used to really terrify me, that now just kind of like, oh, okay, you know, what about the next, you know, what's going to happen next? I don't really care. And that, you know, frees me up to be a lot more effective in my life, because I'm not, you know, continually trying to plan for how to fix a problem. And the only problem I still really try to plan is, you know, financial money. I'm, you know, constantly trying to think, you know, how can I get more money, which is really kind of dumb because I always have everything I need. but for some reason I think I'm not going to in the future. And,
well, that's a good reminder. I certainly can relate to that, and I think it's just a reminder that, you know, we still need to be patient with ourselves because we still think we need things in the world, and doesn't mean we shouldn't do the appropriate things to you know, bring in financial resources for ourselves and our families, and you know, do all the usual, you know, stuff that we've talked on countless occasions about level of confusion and going past that trap of the ego. But it's we've made a curriculum that seems pretty challenging until we recognize that, you know, we are provided for, and not in a material sense, but in a spiritual sense. We have the resources that allow us to be at peace, and ironically, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, when we are choosing the teacher of peace, we not only have more ideas within our realm of choices to draw from, but we recognize, more importantly, that things don't have to happen a certain way in the world for us to be at peace. You know, for example, I got a Facebook message the other day from another course person saying, "Hey, I got a ticket to go to the Boston conference. Do you want to go?" And I thought of you first. I thought, well, that was really thoughtful. So I sent back a nice email message and said, you know, it's not in our budget right now, but I appreciate the offer, and hopefully I'll make it to the next one. And I realized I was, you know, for a moment making it a big deal about whether or not I could go or not, because I have enjoyed the ones I've gone to immensely in the past. And then I realized, if I'm making my peace contingent on attending or not attending a specific event, I'm forgetting what the course is about altogether. Mm-hmm. And I actually do have a tremendous amount of fun just doing the things that I do every week from here. And if in the future I, you know, go to another conference or don't go to another conference or do anything or not do anything, it really is immaterial to whether or not I'm choosing the teacher of peace. So anyway, but yeah, your point is well taken about how, you know, it's so tempting to think that it's about things happening or not happening in the world, including financial things, biological health related things, you know, through our relationships with everyone and everything in the world. But it's always an opportunity to get back to our mind and a decision point in our mind where we choose one or two teachers. And that's the decision we must make, as today's workbook lesson suggests. You're the heaven of the peace of independence, right?
Absolutely. So do you want to read on?
Sure. Okay. So the next paragraph says, "The decision to be angry and to attack people was really a decision to make sin real because it keeps us separate. Thus, the, quote, mighty purpose, unquote, of our wish to be separate was to keep our individuality safe and secure. This, quote, dedication to sin, unquote, is the ego's, for its very existence as an individualized entity is dependent on our belief in the separation, which is the definition of sin. Remember that A Course in Miracles defines the ego as the thought of separation. We have seen other times that what makes sin real to us is our experience of guilt. And since guilt always demands punishment, down goes the gavel in the courtroom, in the ego's courtroom anyway, the results of our dedication to sin must be pain, misery, suffering, sickness, death, despair, depression, anxiety, fear, and terror." Well, there's a pretty good list for those. For the possible side effects on the drug of ego that zip past in the commercial, right? try the new reformulated ego. Side effects may include. Right? Okay. Again, this passage is assuming now that we are really letting go of our investment in anger because we truly want to return to peace. So lots there. I'll continue on though, just so we can get to the next page.
Okay.
We'll keep reviewing this over and over again until we get it. Okay, now he's quoting again from where he picked up where he left off in chapter 19. "This feather wish, this tiny illusion, this microscopic remnant of the belief in sin is all that remains of what once seemed to be the world. It is no longer an unrelenting barrier at peace. Its pointless wandering makes its results appear to be more erratic and unpredictable than before. And Ken comments, our resistance, which can feel like a granite wall, is just a, quote, feather, unquote, a, quote, tiny illusion, unquote, a, quote, microscopic remnant, unquote. The world, in truth, is nothing but the expression and form of the tiny mad idea. That's that outer shield of oblivion, and the mad idea being the inner shield of oblivion. In other words, the world is nothing, having come from nothing. Ideas not only do not leave their source, but they remain one with it as well. Nothing remaining at one with nothing, therefore, results in nothing.
Wow, that sounds like a Billy Preston song.
Yeah, very good, I like that. Yeah. That's great, Lynn. Moreover, assuming that we have already chosen peace, we're at the point where we have let the world go. But not totally, because the wish for individuality or separation is still wandering around in our minds. This reflects the experience of getting upset, yet realizing on some level that it is over nothing. Much ado about nothing, says Billy Shakespeare. Huh?
Yep.
Yeah, Billy Preston, probably. Yeah.
Nothing from nothing means nothing.
Yeah,
you gotta
that's
have
great.
Something.
I've thought about that song for a long time. I have to look that up. Again, our daily practice entails the growing realization that everything that concerns us, without exception, it's italicized, is really nothing. Put that in our mind and let it roll around and grow. And do you want to continue from there?
Sure. Yeah, we still have.
Just read?
No, I think this is. Let's just continue this next little bit here because. I'll read it. The next line is very important from a psychological point of view. Yet, what could be more unstable than a tightly organized delusional system? A tightly organized delusional system. Oh my God, do I know that.
You know what comes to mind is some of those transuranium elements in the atomic chart that are so unstable that they only last for, you know, nanoseconds or maybe milliseconds, you know, because they're just, there's all the forces that make them want to disappear. I won't go into, you know, the technical physics, mostly because I don't understand. but as I recall from those classes, it's like there's things beyond uranium in the atomic the table of atomic elements that many of which were discovered where my dad worked in Livermore, California, and similar places around the planet. You know, they have a half life or a statistical, you know, duration measured in tiny, tiny amounts of time. And so they have to, you know, use really fancy equipment just to put those things together temporarily so they can measure what they do or don't do and you know, spend huge number of amounts of our taxpayers' dollars to try to understand what the universe is based on. These things that only seem to exist for tiny fragments of time, but then are gone almost before you can make a sneeze, you know. I mean,
exactly.
actually before you can make a sneeze.
Yes, and the only way that you can actually detect them is by their effect. You can't actually detect them because they're fleeting, but you can detect from their effect, just like everything else. That's the only
exactly. They don't really exist in truth, but we've developed a system of measurement of illusion that allows us to measure what wasn't ever in existence and quantify it in amazing ways, huh?
Exactly. Amazing.
So is that.
I love it. But you know, what he's saying, what can be more unstable than a tightly organized delusional system? What he was really saying is that the system itself is organized to not make sense.
The
way that it's organized, the way the ego is organized, is to not make sense. And all it does is have, it's all just kind of random collection of experience and thought that are just presented to us. We're just seeing something that through our own thinking we thread together and make a story about.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual system of the ego, none of it makes sense. It is completely delusional.
It is. And just to qualify that, it doesn't make sense to our right minds, because our right minds, looking at the insanity of the ego, immediately recognize that anything that is based on non-existent self-destruction and mutually assured annihilation, as in the entire cosmos of the ego's insane dream is ultimately a black hole, and every seeming part of it is a black hole, which my colleague Nassim Haramein suggests in some of his commentaries on modern physics. You know, maybe every the center of every atom is a black hole. You know, or what if
that guy? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, well, what if the whole thing is completely consistent, as Ken points out in his commentaries. The ego is completely consistent in its thought system. The Holy Spirit is completely consistent in its thought system. But the distinguishing characteristic between the two thought systems is the Holy Spirit is 100% sane. The ego is 100% insane. And we're just clearly and factually presented a very well-reasoned case by Jesus in his course, that we call A Course in Miracles, to look at the two thought systems, present the evidence, and judge for ourselves what we want to identify with, and recognizing that the insane thought system, in truth, only appears to be punished by its own defenses and its own attacks. And that's really a dream and a delusional thought system that has had no impact on our reality. And herein lies the peace of God, right?
Herein lies the peace of God. Hallelujah, freaking Luya. Isn't that just something to be rejoicing about? Because now, where before, yes, the world did seem to make sense because it all seemed to be linear, in cause and effect and all that kind of stuff. Now, as you're beginning to see that there is no cause, and so what appears to be the effect is just complete illusion. Ideas don't leave their source, and if the idea is nothing, if the source is nothing, then the idea is nothing. And so it's just, once you realize that, then whatever the world presents to you, oh, Lynn, you have cancer. Okay, no, I don't have cancer, but, that's fine. this thing is going to, experience cancer, I guess. It doesn't, there's no reason to react to it in any way other than, okay.
Exactly.
I'm not going to fight this. But that's not what I'm here for. And later on in the book, if we ever were to go into, and I think Carrie and I might be going into the Manual for Teachers or something like that in a future group like we're doing here, Jesus talks to us about what our purpose is here. And as long as we are caught up in acting and reacting to nothing, acting and reacting to the illusion, then we are not useful to him. And no matter how many times we say, I'm here to be only here to be truly helpful, we're not being helpful to him when we're caught up emotionally and intellectually in the illusion. And so we have to come to this point where we see it's nothing and let it go, so that we can be his helpers. And that's what you're here for. That's what I'm here. I'm only here to be truly helpful. Let me get out of the way and let that happen. So
exactly. That's a real point of the kindness that Ken talks about and so much of his work. So anyway, thanks as always. I'm gonna hop over in a couple minutes to Lynn Corona and Tim Wise's weekly class. If you're interested, you can go to sfacim.org, the School for A Course in Miracles, and they have weekly classes on Saturday mornings. Actually, they start half an hour before ours is over at 8 o'clock Pacific time, and also Tuesday mornings and Wednesday evenings, and they do that on a donation basis. And I highly recommend. They're wonderful course teachers, and they give presentations frequently at Rocky Mountain Miracle Center in Denver. And so anyway, just a little quick plug for them, and also as always for Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles, whose two websites respectively are facim.org and acim.org for the two organizations, and you can always reach me through acimblog.com. So anyway, have a great week, and I know you're heading out to the conference in Boston, and I'll look forward to getting reports from all kinds of folks about that, and if there's anything online, tune me in.
I'll do
and,
that.
Have a great week, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and blessings to you. All right, now I'm going to turn the mic over to Carrie and Iris.
Right. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Yes, Lynn, you hit it right on the head. You know, that's really what we need to realize, that in order for us to be helpful to Jesus, you know, we have to be willing to allow ourselves to be happy in doing it. You know, and yesterday I woke up and